This podcast is brought to you by Nordic Business Forum, the greatest business show on earth. If you'd like to support Boss Level, go to Twitter and say thanks to @NBForumHQ or go to nbforum.com/Sweden and sign up for the event updates of their upcoming Stockholm event in January 2017. The early bird tickets are available only for 48 hours once they start selling. Okay, so as you noticed, the podcast now has its first sponsor, which is awesome. I've attended Nordic Business Forum in Finland for the last 3 years, and one of my favorite takeaways came in 2013 when Vijay Govindarajan introduced me to his three-box strategy model. Box number one is about managing the present, box number two about selectively abandoning the past, and box number three about creating the future. I love the model, and I've been using it ever since. I'll put a link to it, and I'll put a link to Nordic Business Forum in the show notes, so go check them out. Now, let's get to the show. Today, we have a very special guest, Jari Sarasvuo. In Finland, he doesn't really need introductions, but since the majority of listeners are not from Finland, I'll give you the cliff notes. So Jari first became known for his work in radio and TV. Then, in 1990, he founded a company called Trainer's House that delivers management consulting and training for executives. Jari is still one of the biggest owners of Trainer's House, but he now has a new endeavor called Stronghold. Stronghold caters to a broader audience with a combination of digital and face-to-face trainings. Jari is the author of several best-selling books. He's also very active on Twitter and has roughly 109,000 followers. Our talk covers Jari's Twitter mania, his troubled relationship with technology, his digital training business, and we close off by discussing self-organizing companies and performance targets. Enjoy.
Yes, my judgment earlier was that online training or digital training will never become a big force. I did not believe in digital training, and that's because of my past. I started my company in 1990, 25 years ago, and I had two partners who were extremely tech-savvy at that time, extremely. They were first to notice and pick up and adapt to everything that ever emerged in the digital arena, technological arena. And because everything was slow and not working in 1990, 1991, 1992, 1993, 1994, I learned that, you know, we had this other guy who established Riot E later on, Jan Vellman. It was something like 93, he came to me and he said, "Jari, there is this internet. It's a network formally for military and academic purposes, and now it's released to the all the peoples and of the world. And with this internet, every computer can be connected to every computer. Do you understand that what that means?" And I said, "I understand. It's something unbelievable in the concrete sense of the word, unbelievable. Doesn't mean anything." And he said, "You know, this data transfer and all this, all these connections, and it will mean that all information and all entertainment and almost all of the services will be available to anyone, anywhere, anytime." I said, "That's nice. Let's do it."
And, and he was saying this in 93?
93.
Wow.
He was a visionary. Yeah. He truly was a visionary. But the modems, the ability to actually connect and transfer data, the technology was so slow, and then it abruptly ended. And then after very much struggle, we got it working, the connection working again, and then it was slow, and then it ended. It broke down the connection. I started to hate the idea of internet and digitalization and all this. In addition to this, my partners, Mikko Myyriläinen and the ones already mentioned, Jan Vellman, they created these leadership environments with Macintoshes. And it turned me into a very handicapped person. In English, there is this expression of to create a handicap. To create a handicap means that if something is done for you completely and you do not participate, you just, you know, eat the fruits of other people's learning and working and so forth. It made me totally hapless. It made me an alien in the digital world.
So other people were doing all the digital things that needed to be done, but they were doing them for you.
Yeah. So two things happened. First of all, I did not trust the technology because it did not work. It was slow. It was really expensive. Really, all the money we managed to scrape to our pockets vanished immediately when the guys bought something, a new gadget or something.
Yeah.
New hard drive or something. I did not trust the technology and I didn't really know how to use it. And this went on and on. And when my organization grew, everything was done for me. And I became a digital idiot. Total idiot. And you changed it, Sami.
Really?
You changed it. Because in this very room, we sat here, it was between Christmas and New Year 2012.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
You helped me to Twitter.
Yeah.
And it changed my life. And now I do 85% of my training online. I'm the guy who started really late with no skills. No skills whatsoever. Some instincts, though, but no skills. And I watched as the whole crowd, they ran in the horizon. I could only see the little cloud of dust getting further away from me. And I started to slowly creep behind. But the benefits of digital training, online services, marketing, leadership are so immense that despite the fact of my handicap, I have reaped fantastic rewards. And I really feel grateful for you. You opened a door to a new world for me. Thank you for that.
Well, thank you. That was crazy because I remember when we created your Twitter account and it only took like a day or two for you to have like 10,000 followers. And I remember that also your former colleagues and like people you know, they started calling you and asking you like, is this Jari really you? Yeah. Because they didn't believe that you were on Twitter.
They had suspicions, yes. Yeah. They all doubted my authenticity. I understand that.
Yeah.
But I love communication and I love deep contact and I love the ability to reach people far away and different people. To me, the most fantastic thing about internet and Twitter and online world is the fact that very different people can connect and become friends and start to trust each other and only short time after that, they start to work with each other, and that happens.
Yeah, and I mean, you picked up on Twitter really quickly. I mean, the fact that you didn't like, I remember that I recommended to you that maybe you should just like start sharing the books that you're reading or something like that. And now that I look back on it, that was actually a pretty stupid advice because what you've been doing so much better in Twitter is just like having conversations there with people. And you've been doing that really well. You've been engaging with people a lot there.
Yeah, I actually converse with anarchists, extreme leftists and right-wing people, racists, people who think that the poor should not complain at all, and the people who are poor and cannot find any way out of their situation. I have this dialogue going on with everyone. I do not block people. Sometimes they are so annoying that I put them to the box for a while, meaning I mute them for a while. Then I, kind of let them start to hear their voice again. And slowly we have learned to behave with each other. And of course, some people think that if you're not with us, you are automatically against us. Or if you listen or express any kind of respect towards people who should be condemned for being, for example, racist or anarchist or something, you need to be punished or something socially. I don't believe so. I believe that we're all humans. We all fear. We're all ignorant. We're all limited with our perspectives and understanding. And somehow we all try to cooperate. We reach towards each other, even though it sometimes is really clumsy or even violent.
What do you feel about the environment in Twitter? Because I remember that you were kind of worried about, I guess it's kind of with in relation to like how people have written about you in the media in the past and so on. And I remember that we kind of had this discussion on like, because it's an open media and anyone can say anything, and you were kind of worried of like what's going to happen with that. And so have you, like, how do you feel about that now? Is it, has it been a negative, has it had negative effects?
I expected more social violence directed towards me. And especially the first 2-3 years, I was really surprised and happy because people were behaving respectfully and openly towards me and very many other people. I think Twitter somehow, because of the limitation of 140 characters, somehow it filters people. Most of the people who love to rant and rave are in Facebook. Facebook is, it's more jungle-like. Twitter is like a city. People are civil towards each other. But nowadays, it has changed too. Twitter too has become more blunt or sometimes not so nice in the way of connecting with other people. Nonetheless, it's way safer to kind of experience people's thoughts and feelings about you on the open space than via some media who's always twisting and filtering and coloring and creating meanings that do not exist in the communication. So I think it's rather fair environment to meet people, especially people who are different and who have opposing opinions.
How much do you feel that you need to restrain yourself on Twitter?
It's been like meditation for me. It's been like it's like a mental health exercise not to write what you feel or what you think. I have not always been able to restrain myself, but most of the time I try to be nice, and I try not to. When people expose themselves unsafely, when they really are dumb, I try not to punish them for their stupidity. And I'd say that 4 times out of 5, I'm, you know, on the good side, standing in the light. And then sometimes I kind of I end up standing in the dark, in the shadows myself. And I try to, it is self-education, not to take advantage of some people's mistakes or their temperament. Social media is a place where you have to have manners. Otherwise, you marginalize yourself.
That's definitely true. Yeah. Mm. Yeah. Okay. So going back to your business, or how that has changed into being more digital, or actually pretty much completely digital nowadays. How has that changed the nature of it? Because I mean, I've attended your trainings, and what you do really well is engage with the audience. You're like everyone is paying very close attention and like listening to you very intently. And a lot of that, I think, comes from your like physical presence there. And now with like the digital trainings that you do, you're not there anymore physically. And you're talking to people over a computer. So how does that change the nature of your work?
Sometimes people actually put that question a bit differently. They even say that, how can you connect with anyone if you're talking to the computer?
Mm-hmm.
When we had our telephone conversation, I did not feel or think that I was talking to the telephone. I was talking to Sami.
Yes.
I was connecting with you. Of course, yes. There was this technological apparatus in between us that enabled the connection. Same thing with the computer. I'm not talking to the computer. I'm using computer to reach hundreds of people somewhere else, elsewhere, in a place I don't know where they are. Very many people are having a walk. It's like a walking meditation. They receive my training or my message or my monologue in their phones, and they're using their earphones, and they are walking and concentrating because there's no distraction, and the physical movement kind of lulls them into the trance that, you know, serves our connection.
Yes.
Some people are home, some are in cafeterias, and some are, you know, abroad on vacation. It doesn't matter where they are, I feel them. Now, this sounds pompous, this sounds preposterous, but it actually isn't. Yesterday, we launched or started our online training program for entrepreneurs. A little over 200 entrepreneurs. And I take the list of the people, and there are some names I know. I have acquainted with them. Some people I have even met, because I still do meet people, of course.
Yeah,
I'll come back to that a bit later. And I create this trance to myself that I really, really use my imagination and my bodily sensations so that I feel that we are in the same space. Somehow the computer brings the people to me, not me to them. Even though I understand when we're having a webinar, I'm talking, they are receiving. I'm sending, they are receiving. But I try to turn that upside down to working just the opposite direction, creating a sensation in my body, actually my body, that I am feeling them like right now. And you can sense that. Listener, you know, wherever you are, Mrs. Reddit, you can sense it. Now, you have to kind of abandon yourself. You have to, you know, let go everything that you used. Because sometimes when we meet other people, we have these reservations at all this. Now, somehow we have to manage to become shameless or without guilt, self-hate. You reach and connect and touch people when you forget yourself. Online works just the same way as physical encounters.
I remember you picking up on signals such as like facial expressions of people. And I remember you commenting at one of the trainings that you held on how people took eye contact before the training started and how many people introduced themselves to you before the training. And that you can't do, or can you?
No. And now, to be honest, I think my business model is still a hybrid training. We have physical meetings. We have this different kind of encounters where we are breathing the same air.
Yeah.
And that will never disappear.
Mm-hmm.
It will not go away. We will need each other's actual presence. Online will not magically make us indifferent to physical encounters. What online does is that it gives us more opportunity to be in contact when it's possible to be physically seeing and interacting with each other. What online does is it increases the probability of us ever meet. Because when you reach very many people, you would not have met otherwise. Someday, our paths cross. So it actually increases the number of physical encounters and meetings and bonding also that way. It's not my intention to forget or bypass this moment we're sharing now. It's my intention to create more meaning, more intensity also to those physical encounters.
So what you're doing is you're broadcasting your message to a larger audience, and then the ones who are really interested, they come forth.
Yes.
And you meet them physically.
Yes, I actually have built a house where I meet people. No commercial agenda.
Mm-hmm.
They just come and we serve each other. We meet. We enjoy each other's stories, passions, and so forth. Sometimes that leads into commercial contracts. But most often not. I would estimate that 85-90% of my work is without money. There is no commercial dimension. But
wow.
I'm making more money than I used to. There is more free content, more free emotion, more free inspiration, ideas, opportunities. Without this obligation to buy something. And it's a paradox. The more you give free, the more you get actually money. Because the number of those people who want to deepen the relationship, who want to reap all the benefits, who want to leverage their opportunities by actually buying something, buying online course or buying intensive session or so forth. So this Matthew effect and this idea that the more you give, the more you reserve, and the more you share, the more is shared to you. And that means that those people who have big audiences get even bigger audiences because they deserve it. Those who have will be given more. Those who do not have the respect, trust, affection of a growing audience, they are losing their small audiences as well, which is, of course, somehow unfair, because there are people who would need and perhaps even deserve bigger audience and therefore better income. But they cannot accomplish that. And part of the reason why they cannot accomplish that is simply that they just don't give enough for free.
How did you come to this? I mean, when did the idea come to you that this is the way it should go?
Marketing itself, for decades or for over a century now, has been based on the idea that there is surplus. You reach more people than will ever be served with your products or services. Of course, there will be always those people who hear your message but don't want to participate in the parade. The idea itself, this idea of abundance, of theory of increasing returns, it's almost, I would say it's eternal. It is eternal, you know.
Yes.
There's two fish and five pieces of bread and yes, all this. But in the era of online businesses, online services, online marketing, online content marketing and relationship marketing, it's even more evident than ever. Because your ability to start sharing and to really reach huge audiences is, of course, the cost for every new contact has plummeted. It's almost, you know, non-existent. When I started, once again, thanks to you, with Twitter, I understood that the more you open yourself to people who suspect you, who have prejudices against you, and the more you service those people who judge you, the bigger your audience becomes. And they often, yes, they start their relationship with an insult. That's the most common way to start a relationship with me. You start with an insult. I have always hated you. I have always thought you as a, you know, shallow and stupid asshole. And then they see that I sincerely want to understand and want to be of service. And, you know, converts are the most zealous followers, as we all know.
Yes. So how's the business going so far? You mentioned that it's been growing nicely, and you have like 14,000 people in your active audience. How's it looking?
It's amazing because it's profitable. It's so really, really damn profitable. The more you give for free, the bigger the profit margins are. It's amazing. It's like alchemy. It's like, you know, it makes servicing other people for free, even those people who are not grateful, who are, you know, sometimes abusive, but you still service them, and all of a sudden they buy.
Yeah.
And they become really happy and devoted customers. So it's fantastic. It's like a philosophy.
Yeah.
Yes, the business is good. And I will take it to the, also I will transport this idea and thinking to the stock listed company I own, this Trainers House PLC, because they need that too, and very many others. So it will not be only this stronghold community that benefits from this. I truly intend to share.
Now that you've talked about how the digital world has changed the way you do business, and in the beginning you mentioned that you don't trust technology, or you didn't used to trust technology. Has that changed now?
No. No. Sami, what's on my wrist?
It's a watch.
What watch?
Apple Watch.
Apple Watch today. This is my. These are the very first hours I'm wearing Apple Watch, and this is my first. Well, this is not my first iPhone, because the previous iPhones I purchased, this is my fifth iPhone I bought, but this is the first one that actually is connected to the to the operator. This is the first one that's actually operating and functioning. I still have these problems. I still, you know, I will never become native, well, that's for sure. And I will never start to feel at ease with technology. This is a troubled relationship. And therefore, every little advance I manage to make is such a moment of joy. For example, my Apple Watch and my iPhone, the fifth, they are paired. Do you understand? These are communicating via Bluetooth. So it's, I'm like, you know, I'm ahead of the curve. Listen, I'm ahead of the curve.
Yeah, that's amazing.
I'm still working with my attitude. I'm sorry.
Yes. Okay. Okay. Awesome. Yeah. So shifting gears a little bit. Another topic that I thought, or that I want to talk to you about, or talk with you about, is management and leadership concepts that are upcoming. Because you have a lot of experience with these things. I mean, pretty much, like all the Finnish big companies have bought services from Trainers House, the company that you own, and you've worked with in so many situations, and you're with your own companies also. There's a lot of very twists and turns in their history, and now there's a lot of new waves, and I'm sure you've kind of kept up on or have been listening and paying attention to these trends, such as self-organizing companies, and what are your thoughts on self-organizing companies?
Four words. Top down is dumb. It's sheer stupidity. Top down is dumb. It's an old paradigm that did not work even then. Nature is self-organizing. And networks of people and data and processes and production are actually have started to work like biological systems. For real. The networks of people, data, production and processes and logistics and so forth, they are alive. They have almost conscious. They're almost conscious. The idea that someone somewhere high up could know more, could make better decisions, or even have enough power to make us jump, I'm sorry, it's absurd. It's preposterous. Those people who meet with customer, or those people who solve problems, know always more about customers and problems than those people who do not solve problems but hear about them via numbers, accountants. The idea that from away, from far away, high up, you could see better, understand better, make better decisions, and have the execution power to actually change things doesn't work. It comes from bottom to up, where people meet other people, where they experience all kinds of pains and pleasures of everyday work in both their lives and their works. So self-organizing is the only way to keep this place sane. Workplace and your private life and societies and countries and the whole humanity. There will be authority, of course, meritocracy. It's not based on position. It's not based on your title or education. It comes from the power people give you, not yes. from the power from where other authorities are vesting in you. The whole thing of working, the whole idea of working is changing very rapidly mm-hmm. these years. And technology, by the way, is enabling this.
Yeah, and I think one of the changes that's also happening is that any like leadership role that exists within a community, it doesn't have to be static anymore. It's possible for it to be kind of like on demand, that different people lead in different situations.
Yes.
So it's kind of situational.
It's very dynamic. You know, yeah. the roles change, and sometimes you follow, sometimes you lead, sometimes you support, sometimes you're responsible for profit and loss, and it changes all the time. And those who truly have power, they give resources. They ask questions, and based on the dialogue that is created from these questions and answers, they find out and then they give resources. They allocate resources. This command and control doesn't work, but of course someone has to have responsibility for the availability of all necessary resources, and someone must be able to channel those resources where the action is. So the role of top management will change. They will become students of reality. They will become enablers. Of course, they are fast learners. If they are leadership today, it's courage to ask. It's your ability, your boldness to ask right questions and make right decisions and follow up with your decisions and executions, and with this feedback, kind of adjust the channeling of resources. Because there is so much waste, there is so much pain and unfairness and injustice, both in the world and in the workplace. Thus, this is changing, and the best companies have changed about a decade ago.
Yeah.
This is not something that's coming to us from the future. This is something that already echoes to present day from the past. Look carefully, for example, Reactor, Google. There are many, many companies, my company as well. The power is where you meet the customer.
Mm-hmm.
And you should make those people more powerful. That's where your leverage is.
Thinking back on the things that I've heard you talk about is leading sales, for example, through the calendar and leading sales through performance targets and numeric targets and so on. Has your opinion changed on that once you've like learned about self-organizing companies?
Still, the best way to lead any company's resources is to use your customers, and especially non-customers, upcoming customers' calendars. You have to make people see each other and have dialogue and find out mutual opportunities. Selling is seeing people. Marketing is having dialogue between people and masses. And that hasn't changed.
Yeah.
Of course, everything in this world in terms of benefit and usefulness is an upturned U curve, meaning that if you have too much of the good thing, it becomes a bad thing. Medicine turns into poison. It's a question of how much you apply it. But you have to help people in your organization to meet with people who have all kinds of reasons not to buy. And understanding those reasons and understanding the reasons why they maybe should buy, and creating solutions that build bridges, not put up walls between organizations and people, this will change the prosperity of both the client and the company.
So what I'm kind of getting at is well, you've read Daniel Pink's work on, like, for example, The Drive, where he talks about how if you have work that is like requires even rudimentary like thinking or rudimentary
creativity,
then like monetary rewards are actually have a negative impact.
Well, I totally agree. In the statement I just gave previously in the last little lecture I gave you, I was not talking about performance-related compensation. I don't believe in performance-related compensation. I don't believe in bonuses that are handed out like commissions. Mm-hmm. I believe in bonuses that are shared after profits are declared.
Okay.
Money is a bad motivator. It actually erodes your motivation. Punishment is even worse. Promotion is a bad motivator. The actual meaning of the work is a good motivator. People's opportunity to learn, possibility to grow is a good motivator. Giving power to people, autonomy, is a good motivator. Like Daniel Pink is referring Ryan Enditch's studies. And that's true. That was my Apple Watch. Twitter. I got a tweet. Okay. Now, back to our business. Sorry. By the way, this distraction, this this eats up your brain.
Yeah.
It ups your working memory, your ability to concentrate. I have to do something with this. There must be some way of because this was the first. It's like a little pleasurable electric shock. I'm totally certain that I will become addicted to this. It's like a cancer to your focus.
Yes, yes.
I don't believe in monetary or honorary rewards as in making people run faster. It's a way of controlling. And it eats up your engagement and your creativity and your passion and so forth. I believe in giving power to people who actually solve the problems and do the work. I believe in helping people grow, creating environments where they learn, and of course I believe in creating meaning, this sense of purpose, because people are meaning making machines, meaning that we try to make sense of this world, we try to somehow service our deepest values and core ideas of life. Therefore, this sense of purpose, this constant meaning making is healthy to us. And if something is meaningless, if it's menial, like they say, it's a mental health hazard. And by the way, this doesn't mean that you should not compensate your workers fairly or abundantly. It means that, of course, you give money to them. Of course, you give all kinds of perks and vacation and fantastic places to work. It just means that those things should not be attached directly to your working, the actual what you do or how you perform, because that makes you a machine.
Agreed. Agreed. Yes. Any other topics that we should talk about or that we didn't cover yet?
I believe in human potential. I believe that even though we're living very disturbing times, politically and socially and economically, I believe that human race, we will solve our problems. I believe that things have been progressing towards better for decades and centuries now, and things will continue to progress towards light. These dreadful problems with poverty or climate change, we will be able to contain the problems and find the solutions. We will find solutions towards waste, inequality, hatred. I'm really optimistic. And the darker it gets outside, the more reason I have to believe and hope, because there are so many good things going on. And we should not avert our gaze, our focus, our sights from the good things and start to only focus on the bad things, because that will make us poor and afraid and wasteful and violent. I'm a believer in human potential.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, that was a fun interview to make. I hope you enjoyed it too. Share your thoughts on Twitter with the hashtag BossLevel. If you're new to the podcast and like this episode, don't forget to subscribe and to check out earlier episodes. One of my personal favorites is the one with the CEO of a company with 10,000 employees and zero managers. It's episode number 10. Thanks for listening. Have a great week.